This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the Nolan podcast this morning, the leader, not for much longer, the SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood, sits down with us for an hour talking to us about his political career. Well, he's not, his political career isn't dead, he's just not going to be the leader anymore. The trials, the tribulations, the ups, the downs, and his advice for the next leader, Claire Hannah. I'm not allowed to say that because she hasn't declared, but both Matthew and Colm have said she's the right person for the job, so you know what I mean. All coming up this morning.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. So, Colm Eastwood's had enough as being the leader of the SDLP. He announced yesterday he's going to leave that role. He's going to stay within the party. He's currently the MP for Foyle. He'll continue on that position. So why? Why has he had enough? Good morning, Colm. Good morning, good morning. Is the weight lifted off your shoulders? Do you feel like a free man?
Feel great, actually. Yeah, look, it's a change is as good as a rest, as people say. But look, I've done the job for 9 years, second longest ever leader of the SDLP, and in that time I've fought 10 elections, which I hadn't actually quite realised until someone told me that yesterday. That's a lot, and I think it's time now for somebody else to take the lead, and I think that transition is shaping up well. But look, I'm very determined to stay very involved in politics. I listened to a Vox Pop on Radio Foyle this morning, and it sounded like I was up my own wake. But I'm not dead, and I'm not done. I'm very determined to be very involved in politics, just in a slightly different way.
You're a relatively young man, Colm. You're 41. So you've achieved a lot at a relatively young age.
I wish you'd stop saying relatively, but anyway, thanks.
To walk away from being the top dog, from being the leader of the party, there must have been a lot of thinking around that.
Yeah, of course. And
so why?
Well,
why now?
Well, I have been doing the job since I was 32, which is, you know, unusual. And I suppose I probably always knew that I would have to leave the job at a young age. And it is rare enough in politics that you get to pick your own moment. I mean, people are usually dragged out of these positions. And I was, I think, probably determined in my own head that that wouldn't happen.
Did you sense it could be happening?
No, it's nothing like that, actually, at all. I just knew it was a good time after we set out, I suppose, to retain those two seats at Westminster. And we had to have a very kind of particular strategy to do that. It's unheard of, actually, in the last 20 years where the SDLP would take seats back from Sinn Féin and take a seat back from the DUP and then hold them. So that was a big challenge for us, particularly, you know, given the political context that we've been in for the last few elections. So we were determined to do that. And I think just at that point after, I was able to sit down and take some time to myself and with friends and supporters and just think about it. And I think, I suppose, because I am 41, I want to have a second act in politics. And I do think how you end the first act is probably important to make sure that you can have a second.
I want to talk about your vision for the party, your vision for, you know, why you think Claire Hannah should lead the party. But just to get some of the basic questions done and dusted, did Claire Hannah or Matthew O'Toole ever have a conversation with you about, Colm, maybe it's time now to refresh the party leadership?
No, not at all. In fact, it was the other way around. I mean, I spoke to Claire about that, and I felt when I had kind of come to my own decision, and I was getting there anyway, but I just needed to be very focused on the Westminster election. But when the election finished and when we broke up for the summer from Westminster, I was able to go away for a few days, and you get a great sense of perspective when you do that. And I was very clear and very comfortable then in the decision. And then I had a few conversations with Claire, and you know, we're great friends, and we have been for a long time, and particularly over the last 5 years at Westminster. We've worked really closely together, and there's something about the job of actually being a leader in any organisation that you get to understand, and it's only with doing it you get to understand the qualities that are required in a leader. And I just have seen Claire operate up close, and I'm just very sure that she's the right person. Well,
you said it was the other way round. Did Claire or Matthew try to convince you to stay?
Well, I think I don't really want to go into the details of those conversations.
That's a
But I came to Claire with the decision made, basically. And I think it's fair to say, Claire, you know, like a lot of people who should be leaders will be reluctant enough, you know. And I sometimes think the people that put their hands up for these jobs are the wrong people. And the people who think more carefully about their own, you know, they think more carefully about whether they should do it or not and whether they're the right person. I think that says something about person that is a very good quality, that they're not just jumping straight in thinking they'd be the best person in the world. And when other people have to convince them, I think that's a good thing.
So did you have to convince her?
I mean, I think, I think we'd both been thinking about it and having conversations around it. And I think, like all of us, you come to your own position, and Claire will announce, she's more conversations to have over the next few days, and Claire will announce what she's going to do, I would assume, next week. And, you know, that's for Claire.
She's really decided,
that's for Claire,
right?
To do. Well, you need to speak to Claire about that. But you have
spoken to her. It would be pretty farcical for both you, as the leader of the party still, and the leader of the opposition, Matthew O'Toole, to be on the airwaves saying Claire Hannah is the person to lead our party if you don't know she's going to run. Going to run.
All I'm going to say is I can make my announcement about what I'm going to do, and Matthew can make his. And I think it's we have to let Claire have a bit of time over the weekend, and let's see what happens.
So she's thinking about it, is she?
Well, I'm trying to tell you, Stephen, it's up to Claire now to make her announcement, and I think people should be given that opportunity. I announced this yesterday. Let's see what happens over the weekend. But look, all I'm going to say to you, Stephen, is I think this will be managed in a professional way.
It's already managed, isn't it? It's all stage managed.
Well, no. Let's just see what happens. We need to ensure that things are done properly, and there's a process, and let's go through the process.
Well, look, it's very clear that you want Claire Hannah to get it. Why Claire and not Matthew?
Well, it's not like that. I mean, frankly, I think Matthew would be a fantastic leader as well, and he is a leader in the SDLP. He's a leader of the opposition, a position, you know, that I appointed him to because I knew he would be a kind of a standout performer in Stormont, and that we needed somebody with that real analytical ability to go through what the executive were going to do and to provide, you know, a different option for people. And so he's absolutely fantastic. He's got a huge brain and a great ability to communicate. I suppose my view just is in this moment that Claire is the right person to give that overall leadership
but
of the party and direction.
Look, clearly you support Matthew O'Toole. I get it. I hear it. I'm not trying to undo that. But it's not just about this moment. You think Claire you had to choose. And you've chosen
that's
Claire.
That's life.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
You know, so what has Claire got that Matthew doesn't? Is it experience or what is it?
It isn't really about that. It's just that in this moment, I think that Claire, I think everybody kind of accepts that Claire Hannah is an exceptional talent, an extraordinary communicator, somebody who is, you know, frankly, well-liked, well beyond our own political base, which is a very strange thing in politics. And that, for me, just makes it an obvious choice. And there's all this sort of Kremlinology about relationships in the SDLP. Look, I think we're just all very good friends. And what has happened over the last couple of years in particular is we've had a broad leadership approach to lots of things. That Claire and Matthew, myself and Daniel and others have worked really closely together on all these things. And I just think it's obvious that Claire should be leader, and everybody can see her just natural talent. And I'm really looking forward actually to working with her if she takes on the role, and whoever takes on the role, I'll be there as a loyal servant and supporter.
You mentioned Daniel there, and I heard Matthew say that he's lost his mum. So, at the weekend, is that right? So our thoughts are with him.
He'll very much appreciate that. He's had a very rough few weeks, and it's just been tough on him. And to all his credit, he was there yesterday when I was making my announcement. He's the party chairman and doing a fantastic job, and somebody's really committed, and he was very close to his mother, and it's just not easy.
Look, people can read into different optics around things. Why did you do that on your own yesterday, make that announcement, rather than Claire and Matthew by your side?
Yeah, I always thought that was funny that people were commenting on that. I think that leaders have to lead, and I think in moments where you're kind of talking about yourself and your own future, you should probably stand there and do it yourself. And I just think that's the way it's done. I always remember Seamus Mallon when he was announcing his retirement. He from politics. That's not what I'm doing, but he went and did it himself, and I always thought it was kind of impressive. I just don't think you always need people beside you in order to say what you've got to say. And, sometimes you have people beside you, sometimes you don't. I think it was some people were reading a bit too much into that.
Your words today, they are clichéd in terms of your support for the next leader. The reality is that, human nature, you were the guy at the front leading. Now you're not going to be top dog, and someone else is going to be making some decisions that you won't like. What's that going to feel like?
It's going to feel like life. You got to remember, I've been in this party since I was 14 or 15 years old. I've seen lots of leaders. I've been supportive of almost all of them, and I'm very comfortable in that. I'm a kind of political activist first and foremost. I love representing the people of Derry. That is genuinely what I'm really passionate about, and I'm also really passionate about building the case for a new Ireland, and I'm going to get stuck into that in a way that I probably wasn't able to do when I was managing the day-to-day politics of running any political party. So I've done it, I've done it for a very significant length of time. It's not that I'm tired of it. I know somebody wrote that I was burnt out. I actually don't feel burnt out at all. I feel really, really energized by what comes next. Being
the
MP for
Fife. That's a strange thing to say when you're walking away from a big job.
Well, I'm walking into doing it in a different way. I'm going to continue to be very, very involved in politics. I don't need the title, to be honest, to do what I want to do. I am genuinely really committed to this big opportunity. I just think we are now moving into an exciting period in Irish politics, and I want to be part of that. Yes, of course I could be part of that as party leader, but I think there needs to be an energy given to the New Ireland conversation that shouldn't be the kind of thing that you do when you're not doing everything else, when you're not doing, the day job of running the political party. I was talking to Leo Varadkar last night, and he said running a political party is just another full-time, massively full-time job on top of all the other things you've got to do. And when you're in the middle of that, you don't think about it, you just do it. But I want to give more time to politics, really, and less time to kind of management.
Did Leo Varadkar ring you?
He did, yeah.
What did he say to you?
I mean, you love the intrigue around personal conversations, but look, we had a personal. Lots of people.
Well, I didn't hack your phone. You told us you were talking to Leo Varadkar. What did he say?
Lots of people just very, very supportive and wishing me well. And I'm going to see him at a New Ireland Commission event in a couple of weeks in Derry. So, he and lots of others, and I've been very honoured actually by the people who phoned and very significant political figures and ordinary constituency. Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, I've
did Gavin Robinson phone you?
He did. He phoned me.
What did he say?
Phoned me. He was very nice and very supportive. I get on very well with Gavin actually, and we have obviously clashed politically, but we can work together too at times. And I do believe that the job of representing people from here in Westminster. You have to at times be together, and you have to at times work together and stand up for people, no matter what their politics.
Did Michelle give you a ring?
No, not yet, but that's fine. Michelle and I also get on very well, and I'm not really fussy about all that sort of stuff. It's been a chaotic couple of days, actually, and trying to let people know the day before who needed to know and all of that, and then yesterday was kind of mad, but it's been great, and people have been lovely, and the people, frankly, that I kind of think about most in these situations is walking around Derry, and people have been really, really nice, and I had to just remind them that I'm not quite dead, and I'm still going to be their MP, and it's a bit odd being at your own political wake sometimes.
But. Yeah. I doubt Jim Allister phoned you, because I saw the
saw that
the statement from the TV. Colm Eastwood's leadership saw an increasing greening of the SLP, and unionists will never forget that he infamously carried the coffin of an INLA terrorist.
Yeah, graceful as usual from the TUV. But look, that's grand. I'm not too worried, really, about what the TUV think of me. And, you know, I genuinely think I've done an awful lot to reach out to unionists, and people will see that in the round. And actually, I'm probably one of the nationalist politicians who's got more unionist votes than many others. I'm not just sure how many nationalist votes Jim's able to garner.
I have seen up close your passion for your laser focus on Derry and Londonderry and what you want to do for that community. Is it possible that as a political leader, your passion for Derry should have been broader, Colm, for all of Northern Ireland? Well, I'm asking that question genuinely.
No, I get that. And look, I have been accused of that. And I suppose my political hero was always John Hume, and I think he was able to give a vision for the country, but also give massive commitment to Derry. And let me tell you why. Like, Derry isn't an ordinary place. The reason I am passionate and sometimes angry and forceful about the needs of the people of Derry is because I truly believe that the people of Derry, the economy of Derry, has been let down by successive governments that, 50 years of the old unionist government really embedded sectarian disadvantage for the people of Derry. Then violence and the bombing of the city centre destroyed any opportunity for the economy to grow. And since the peace process, I don't believe that successive executives have delivered. I also firmly believe that partition has damaged the prospects of the people of Derry. So, I mean, I think in the broad politics of Northern Ireland, Derry is a case that needs to be dealt with. And the politics that I believe in, which are social democratic
politics. But my question was, as a leader, were
politics,
you too focused on Derry?
I don't think so. I wish other leaders were focused more on actually lifting up the areas of Northern Ireland that have been left behind. And if you're a social democrat, if you believe in lifting people up, out of poverty, giving people opportunity, if you believe in fairness and equality, well, Derry is a case in point that needs to be dealt with. And actually, I think executives haven't done that and could do a lot better.
I heard Matthew talk this morning on Good Morning Ulster about this this vision that your party has for a new Ireland. You've talked about it today. What is this vision? Your party hasn't sold it. What is it?
Well, my view is, well, first of all, I set up the New Ireland Commission, and I think that needs new energy and needs time and needs focus from people like myself, and that's what I'm going to go and do.
Maybe Clare will disband it. You won't decide anymore.
Well, look, the New Ireland Commission will very much exist, and I'm going to run it. And
not
we're
if
going
Clare
to,
decides otherwise.
Well, let's just see what happens. But I am absolutely committed to that cause, and that's what I'm in politics to deliver. Let me tell you what I think it is. I think there are a number of divisions in our society. There's a sectarian division. There's a division around poverty and people and communities that have been left out and left out of access to the economy and opportunity for their children, which has led to many, many people emigrating. We still have an immigration problem in large parts of Northern Ireland. And there's a division on this island, which is a partition. And I strongly believe that if we want to lift people out of poverty, if we want to give people opportunity, if we want to give people access to the economy and build a reconciled, modern, progressive society, then a new United Ireland is the best option for that. Now, but I also am wide open, my eyes are wide open, I've always been saying this, that we have to build that case, that we have to make that case to those people who are interested but unsure, those people who are curious but nervous. That's the job, I think, of the SDLP, but it's also going to be the job that I'm going to be committed to, you know, focused on, and not have to deal with all the day-to-day stuff that party leaders have to deal with.
But if you have failed to land that message, then why are you the best man to continue with it? Why shouldn't it be someone else? You haven't landed that. The TUV are a 9%. Under your leadership, SDLP 8%. That's one poll.
Well, I don't really deal in polls. I did in elections, and we had, I can't remember, it was 11 or 12% of the Westminster election. So let's just see.
But the message hasn't landed enough, has it?
Well, I mean, the message
under your leadership. So what's, I keep on hearing this morning about this new energy that's going to come to your party under Claire Hannah. What is she going to do that you couldn't do?
Well, I'm going to let Claire set out her plans.
But
for
you're
the future.
Backing her. Saying she's the right person to bring this new energy.
Well,
what is she going to bring that you can't?
Well, you've asked me a number of questions there, Stephen. The first question you asked me is, why have we not landed the New Ireland case yet? That's a work in progress. Remember, after Brexit, the whole world in terms of Northern Ireland politics just got thrown up in the air. It was very unstable. But what we have now is people talking about this in a way that they weren't talking about before. It is at the front of the political agenda.
And they're backing Sinn Féin when they're thinking about it.
Well, look, what I'm talking about this is not talking about it in terms of who wins an election. I'm actually talking about it in terms of who wins a referendum and can we build a nation after that. That's the business, actually, that got me excited about being involved in politics. That's a business that I'm going to go and do now. And yes, the SDLP has political challenges, largely because of that instability and the divisions in society that have kind of driven people apart, the instability around the institutions. And I think now, if we can have these institutions bedded down, and if we have 3 years to the next election, if the SDLP is in opposition, and Claire Hannah can, if she takes up the job, is able to lead that new opportunity, which I think it is, I think that is an electoral opportunity. And the one thing about politics is it doesn't go in straight lines. When we lost three seats at Westminster in 2017, people said we'd never get them back. People said we were done, we were finished. And I've been hearing that actually for years. And then we took two of them back, right? And we come very close to taking the third. And we took them in pretty, you know, big, substantial fashion. My election was the biggest swing in the whole of the UK. Claire Hannah's majority was huge, and we kept those seats. So we took seats from Sinn Féin and the DUP, and we kept them. That's, you know, obviously we had difficult elections and other elections. I fought 10 of them as leader.
Your majority was cut quite a lot, Colin, wasn't it?
Well, my majority was cut on a very, very small turnout, and actually a change boundary. And every door I went to, every voter knew my majority. So I think I was damaged a bit by that. But I'm very comfortable actually in that seat, and I think we're back probably to around the right place that we should be in terms of that majority.
In looking at selling this new Ireland in the future under Claire Hannah's leadership, why is Sinn Féin so much a bigger political force than your party? And how are you not always going to be the little brother to Sinn Féin? What is it about Sinn Féin that sells that message much more powerfully than your party?
Well, look, there are a lot of questions around how that all happened. I think the decline in the SDLP's vote came around the time of the peace process, where Sinn Féin were brought in to the fold and the political process, and that had an inevitable impact on our vote. And it was a price worth paying, in my view. And, you know, the stop-start nature of politics, the way the DUP have behaved, have driven people into Sinn Féin's hands.
And they have lifted
the ball and played it very well.
But you've attempted to play it well too. What is it about Sinn Féin? Because if you're going to renew as a party, obviously you're asking yourselves this question.
Of course, look,
it's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge, but things go up and down. And if you look at the elections in the South, Sinn Féin just had a terrible election in the South. We'll see what happens now in November. All political parties go through these cycles, come and go. But to be perfectly honest, I mean, I think what we need to be focused on isn't, you know, how many votes of the nationalist bloc that's already currently thinking in a nationalist way, how many votes go to who. What we need to be thinking about is how are we convincing those people who today wouldn't vote for a new Ireland, how are we convincing them that their place will be secure, that their economic prospects would be better, that their health service would be better, all of that. That is the job, actually, that I want to be involved in. And the leadership of the SDLP will pass to somebody else. So I think the job of convincing people about a different kind of future is the exciting one. And I think that will benefit the SDLP as well.
That then brings us back to that TUV statement and them talking about you carrying the coffin of Seamus Coyle in 2012. He was a school friend. He was also in the ILA, and he was a member of the IRA. Do you think Claire Hannah would carry the coffin of someone that was in a paramilitary group?
Well, first of all, he wasn't a school friend. I mean, he was 57 when he died, but he was a friend. And this is the kind of thing that people at the TV throw at me.
But I'm asking the question, if you're reaching out to people...
I'm trying to answer it, Stephen. They throw this at me on Twitter every day. I still get a huge number of unionist people coming to me every day for help, voting for me in every election I've ever stood in, and people understanding that I have reached out in ways that were difficult and hard, including around the centenary events. And I think I have always demonstrated an ability to do that. I am also not going to pretend that I'm a nationalist. I'm not going to pretend I believe in United Ireland. And I don't think anybody from a unionist background who's serious would want me to either. But one other thing that I'm not going to do is I'm not going to deny friends when they die. People in this society have many people have been on a political journey, a peace process journey. I've always been vehemently opposed to violence. Totally different politics than Seamus Coyle.
How can you say you're opposed to violence and remain friends with someone that was in the IRA?
Well, because was Martin McGuinness always totally supportive of the peace process? Was Gerry Adams?
No.
And there are people within political unionism who gave cover to violence as well. I think people have to be allowed their own peace process, and we can't make these grand statements about peace and bringing people together if we're not prepared to do that in a personal way as well. It's not an endorsement. In fact, you know, and sometimes that annoys me. Some people from a unionist background have a go at me around this. It's harder to be a nationalist leader who believes in the peace process, who stands up to dissident Republicans in our own community. It's harder to do that than it is to do it from the other side. It just is, because we live in this community. We challenge these people all the time. And I think for as one person, I have been brave and committed to that, and nobody could question that. And I wish sometimes unionist leaders would do the same.
You're not dead. You talk about, you know, when you hear people talk about you leaving this post, it's as if you're dead, and you're not dead. So what you still stand for is important. You're currently the MP for Foyle. You're going to continue in that role. When Michelle O'Neill said that there was no alternative to violence in the past, do you agree with her?
Absolutely not. She's totally wrong. And actually, the nationalist people in their hundreds of thousands voted for the SDLP when they had the option to vote for Sinn Féin when violence was continuing. They rejected violence. And if you look at some of the places where the SDLP were winning in those days when the IRA were involved in violence, it wasn't until they stopped that people began to vote for Sinn Féin. The nationalist people, the unionist people, have always rejected violence. There was an alternative, and many, many people opted for that alternative. And at the end of the day, That alternative brought us peace. That alternative brought us the Good Friday Agreement. And that alternative brought us a democratic opportunity to work towards building a new Ireland. Violence failed. The IRA did not win. They were defeated and lots of people died in the process. It was a massive failure. And it has held back the opportunity actually to create a united Ireland for decades.
As Claire Hannah now grasps the role of re-energising your party, how much does money play a factor? I was asking you about Sinn Féin earlier. Sinn Féin brought in over £1 million last year. Your party brought in a third of that. How much does money play a role in a political party being able to win?
Well, when you're up against one of the, probably the best-funded political operation in Europe, then it plays a big role. I mean, if people knew the inequality of arms in terms of political funding and just resource that we were up against, they would be astonished that the SDLP exists at all.
Tell us.
Well, it's just very difficult when you're up against the political operation. And actually, the parties in the South have been finding this over the last number of years. Sinn Féin is extremely, extremely well-funded. And it does make it difficult. And sometimes when you're fighting elections, you're going, how are we even getting any votes given the number
of posters and leaflets and everything else?
Well, they do. Well, I'm just saying in terms of how you manage, you know, being in opposition to that, it is very, very difficult. And that's the way it is. And obviously, you know, and we don't have a great history in the north of Ireland of people, you know, funding political parties. And that's all very understandable.
So what does that money buy?
It's tough. Well, it buys leaflets and posters and Facebook ads and all the things that you have to do to win elections. But you are, I mean, the truth is we are absolutely up against it in terms of our opposition. And it is, yeah, it's difficult, but it just shows the quality, actually, of, you know, hard work and activism on the ground where people are up against that kind of might of an organisation and are still able to win seats and win arguments. And, I mean, I want to also take this opportunity to thank all of the people in the SDLP who work every single day on the ground for no thanks and knock the doors and talk to people and help people and are there for their community. They're the backbone of our political party. They're the backbone of any political party. And they're the ones who have to do the hard slog.
Let me talk to you about Claire Hannah. Because whoever leads a political party, and increasingly actually as you look at politics across the world, personality matters. I don't think there's anyone that would question Claire Hannah has personality. And I don't think there's anyone would question that she is a very, very good communicator. What do you think she's got that she might be able to bring a new energy rather than you're a good communicator, you've got personality. So how can she re-energise? What have you seen that makes you think that she can make any difference than what you've done?
Well, I think she's got star quality, actually. And I think she's got a huge intellect and a massive commitment that I've witnessed for, you know, 25 years to the underdog and the people of this society. She's massively committed to reconciling all of the people, and she's committed to lifting people out of poverty. And she does it in a way that attracts votes and support and kind of good wishes from people that really we have no business attracting. And she's able to do it. And I think that's a fantastic quality. And it's not about, you know, her versus me or anything else. It's just I've done this for 9 years. I want to try to be involved in a slightly different way now. And I just think this is a good moment. Remember, we've got 3 years till the next election. We didn't get a breath. I think in 9 years, I've fought 10 elections. That's pretty unique. And now there's a chance for Claire to you know, do it in her way.
And Colm, there are differences in any organisation. There are differences in the BBC. There are differences within any senior team. What would be Claire's valid, legitimate differences in terms of policy between her and you? What might come new to the SLP through Claire?
Well, look,
in terms of policy,
it really is for Claire to set all that out, and I want to give her the chance to do it if she's going to do it. And I
can we drop this stuff of if she's going to do it? Like you've spoken to her, you and Matthew. Like, come on, it's 2024.
Well, I do respect people's opportunity
yeah,
to make their
own
announcements.
Yeah, but she's told you she's going to run
you know?
For it, right? Or you wouldn't be endorsing her. It would be pretty farcical.
How many times are you going to ask me
yes, but it would be pretty farcical. It's about real politic here for both you and Matthew to be backing someone that's told you I'm not running.
Well,
or I don't
know
if I'm running.
I suppose the real politic is that we're going to let that all work itself out.
Fine. I'll say it. When Claire announces she's running,
right,
what might be the difference in policy where you have maybe had a legitimate difference of opinion and that's all right?
I actually don't think we... people love all this stuff assuming there's big differences in political parties. I mean, genuinely, we work extremely well together. Our offices are literally next door in Westminster. We're both very strong Social Democrats. We believe in a new Ireland.
So no change then, Colin.
I mean, but if anybody thinks, I haven't heard a political commentator yet say that policy is our problem. I mean, we've never been short of good policies. We've never been, not been the pathfinders, I think, for where politics needs to go, or where nationalism needs to go and all that. And I think that's not the problem. The problem is external in a lot of ways. And yes, we have to reflect on our own organisation and all of those things. And there are things that, you know, maybe I could have done better. But we are living in a very difficult political context. But we have done, and Claire and I and others in the leadership have done an awful lot of work to reform the operations of the SDLP. Actually, we've totally changed the constitution. We've changed how the party works. And actually, if you look back 9 years, I think we brought in, I'm proud of the fact that I brought in a new generation of leaders into the SDLP. And actually, we challenged some of the more conservative views that have crept into the party at that point. And I think we needed to bring it back to our kind of radical roots. And we have done that. So we've modernised the party structures. We have modernised the policy base in terms of being much, much more progressive, where, you know, I felt more comfortable and others felt more comfortable. And we are setting out a vision for a new Ireland. That's all good. It takes time to work through. The political context will get better, and that we'll have no election for 3 years and we'll be in opposition. But you know, there's no pretending here. It's tough. It's difficult. It's been tough. But I think there's a place for the SDLP. And if the SDLP didn't exist, you would invent it. So I'm actually really excited about the future.
And behind the scenes, running the party has dragged you down rather than the politics. Is that it? Is that fair?
It's not that it's dragged me down.
I
am the longest standing political leader in the UK. So I don't think I have been dragged down. It's just been long enough. And it's time for everybody and for me to re-energise myself. I don't enjoy managing a political party. I don't enjoy every part of that. It just, you do spend a lot more time than you'd want to do in that. I enjoy politics. I enjoy representing people and making cases for causes, and that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Just a few more minutes. This is not your obituary, but here's a flavour of your time as leader of the SDLP.
We can build a better Ireland. We can build a better Northern Ireland. We can build a fairer future. We can build a better future. Let's build it together.
I'll read out this empty formula in order to represent my constituents, but it's under protest. I do solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty King Charles, his heirs and successors according to law. My true allegiance is to the people of Derry and the people of Ireland. You gotta roll with it, you gotta take it down, you gotta say what you say, don't let anybody get in your way, there's a song too much for me to say. Prime Minister's actions over the last number of months have absolutely eroded public confidence at the worst possible time in a public health crisis, excusing rule-breaking by his own MPs, ignoring rule-breaking in his own house. He can't even lead Tory MPs to vote for his public health guidance.
There's a great sadness across this city, and I just want to say that the people of Derry stand with Lara's family and partner Sarah. We stand resolutely against the violence that was witnessed on these streets.
We have the DUP threatening to bring down the institution.
You can call
let's see where this all ends up for unionism. This is the strategy they're going to adopt.
Well, you may call it a stunt, and you're entitled to do so, but the reality is you've got it now in black and white. You know what's going to happen.
No, I'm sorry. I mean, DUP ministers, like every other minister, have a legal obligation to implement an international agreement that we're all party to, whether I like it or not.
No more excuses will be accepted by the people of our city or the people of Northern Ireland. Let's get back to work.
I have been really privileged to be the leader of the SDLP, but it's now, after a long period in leadership, now time with to give somebody else a chance and to re-energise the party, and I look forward to being there to support them.
But in the Guildhall Square in Londonderry,
what do you make of that as you listen to yourself?
I enjoyed the Oasis song more than the clips, and I'm actually really, really excited that Oasis are getting back together.
You're not another one. This Oasis hyperbole.
I mean, super fan, to be honest.
You'll notice it hasn't been mentioned much in this programme.
And I see good timing with Mike coming back as leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, but we're not going to get that band back together again. Absolutely. never go backwards. I've lots, to be honest, I've lots more to give, and I'm really excited about it.
Let me ask you a few more questions in my head, then we're done. Mm-hmm. And thanks for spending time with us. Sometimes politicians are dehumanized. Mm. What's been the most difficult personal behind the scenes moment for you because of your job as a political leader in Northern Ireland? Because sometimes, as I say, you're attacked so often. So what's been the most difficult time for you as leader?
Well, look, you've asked me a question. I don't tend to talk about stuff like that very often. But it is hard at times, and social media can be, really relentless. I think I've got pretty good at sort of ignoring that. But then you've got the actual death threats as well, which I tend not to talk about too much. And, that takes its toll on probably other people around you more than yourself. But that's
credible,
the nature.
Worrying death threats.
Well, at times, yeah. And that's what it is. That's the nature of the business that we're in. And it's pretty sad that it is the nature. But I also just always remember what previous generations went through in our society, and the sacrifices that they made, the real dangers that they went through so that we could practice our politics in a democratic and peaceful way.
Listen,
and that's, for me, it's a privilege to be able to do that.
I get it. And that's a stock answer.
It's not a stock answer, actually. It's a genuine answer because I saw them up close.
I think a job the media has got to do in the future, right? And I obviously include myself in this. There is a job in Northern Ireland, as well as all of the accountability stuff that the media very much should do. We need to humanise politicians more, in my view, okay? So that's why I'm asking you about the difficult moments. So you talk about social media. And you talk about the relentless nature of it. Does it get to you?
I mean, I think it probably does somewhere, where I'm very good at kind of water off the duck's back and not getting too worried about that kind of thing. But it does impact you. And I think the bigger impact, this is not a stock answer, and you know that I'm not too keen on talking very much about my kind of personal stuff, and I don't like
because
I think your job is
to
represent others. Well, the intention is to kind of wear you down, and it's organised, by the way, and I think someone needs to, if the journalist wants to do a job on that, that's what they should look at.
Let's talk more about that, because I've heard from other politicians telling me the same thing. In fact, someone has said to me it's the biggest untold story in Northern Ireland.
I think that's absolutely true. And so I get it from all, I kind of get it from all angles. So I get it from all you know, variances of headbangers and political activists from different. And the vast majority of them, by the way, are either bots, that they call them, or they're organized in that they basically are turned off and turned on at a moment's notice. So that doesn't happen organically. That is not ordinary people.
Do you think there's a political machine behind that?
I suspect that there is. I can't prove that. But
that would take money, wouldn't it?
Take money, it takes organization. There are also, you know, on other kind of issues like the vaccines and stuff like that, there are people doing that. I don't know where that's coming from, but that's organized as well. It's slightly different to some of the more kind of political pointed stuff that we see here, not just in the north, but also in the south. And I do think that is an area that needs investigated. And look, I'm doing this long enough. It doesn't bother me that much.
But you said it wears you down.
Well, I think they're attempting to wear you down, and at times it does get to you. But what it does actually is it closes down debate sometimes. It makes people think that, and this, it doesn't do this to me, but I know others, it makes people think, well, if I say that, I'm going to get a pile on. Maybe I'll just not say it. And I think that's the intention of it, is that it does close down some debate and some criticism of certain political parties, and it's deliberate. And what that in turn does is it turns people off politics, and it turns people off stepping forward and standing up and, you know, taking the brave decision of running for election. And I just think that's pretty pernicious in a democratic society.
And there must be a number of moments where you have felt either more excited or more proud about something behind the scenes. There must have been moments during your 9 years as a leader. Let's talk about the positives now. I asked you about, you know, that you've just thought, this feels special. This is what I'm in politics for. What were they?
I'm trying to think. I mean, to be honest, there's the small things that you get to do for people are the things that really get me kind of excited, you know. And again, I know I'm always accused of talking about Derry too much, but I do get very kind of proud of things that you're able to do for Derry, and it's always an uphill struggle. You do get those moments. Every politician, I think, will tell you this, the small things that you get to do for people, or you get to fix for people, or when you represent somebody and you get a result. And I mean, I didn't expect the question, so I'll think about it more deeply.
What's your biggest achievement as political leader?
I'm very proud of the fact that we were able to convince the Irish government through Micheál Martin it didn't take much convincing, but to set up the Shared Island Unit and the Shared Island Fund. That is, I think, a huge impact on communities. With Nara Water Bridge has been built because of it. There's been expansion at McGee because of it, and I think that will continue. That's a legacy I'm very, very proud of. And in terms of, you know, I suppose winning my own seat in a dramatic way in 2019, and Claire winning hers was a big moment, and it was an important moment where, you know, people made a big statement, and you know that was nice.
Moments are important, aren't they? Were you delayed in making your announcement because of Doug Beattie's announcement?
I don't think I was delayed, but it was a bit annoying because I had been thinking about it for a while, and I was kind of ready. And I'm one of these people, when you make a decision, you just want to kind of get on with it and do it. So, I think I was probably going to do it this week or next week, actually, anyway. So
I noticed that you said mid-interview this morning that Doug had called you. That must have been an interesting conversation.
Well, I called him when he made his announcement. And then he called me. Yes, it's just, do you know, this is the thing. We're all human beings, and actually, political leaders here spent an awful lot of time together, probably more than in any other place in the world, because of all the negotiations. You get to know people, and I genuinely like the other leaders in the north.
All of them.
I do, actually, yeah. I get on with them in different ways.
Including Jim Alistair?
I get on all right with Jim too. He'll not like me saying that, you know. But we are diametrically opposed to each other in every possible way. But I can still be civil with
people. Do you think, Colm, your next leader, Claire Hannah, will see a united Ireland within her political lifetime?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how long do you give it?
I mean, you'll know that I've been very careful about dates. But I do think
but you've said absolutely. So that's interesting.
But I think by the end of this decade, it is possible that we will have a referendum. But if it's not then, it'll be not long after. I think we will.
Within the next 6 years?
Well, I think definitely within the next 10 years, yeah. And the job of those of us who want to see change is now to make that case and make that argument. And genuinely, that is what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend a lot of time and focus on that because I think it's good for people and it will be good for people.
You're going to spend a lot of time in London?
I represent. I'm going to spend as much time as I have to. Hopefully, I'll be able to spend a bit less time now.
Do you like it over there? That I hate it. The tube and the traffic and... Do you like it over there?
I like Derry better, but I'm sort of used to it, you know. London's a great city. Not that you get an awful lot of time to enjoy it in the way you would if you're on your holidays, but I like standing up for people. I like being in the chamber. I do enjoy the work in the chamber. I hate all of the pomp and ceremony and
much?
All that nonsense.
Obviously I know there's a lot, but does it feel like a lot when you're sitting among us?
It's just mad, and a lot of times it doesn't make any sense to me, and it's just, but it is what it is, and it's their part
in
of
what
it,
way?
And that's fine, and I'm only there
because
I have to
be. What's the most irritating stuff about the pomp? I've often wondered that.
Well, it's all the marching around, you know, every time they open the door, they're marching around, and the speaker marches in every morning. It's just bonkers, but that's up to them. I'm kind of there because I have to be, because the people there need to be represented. I'm not there because I really want to be. I'd rather be sitting in Dáil Éireann, if I'm perfectly honest. But that's for another day.
We're 4 minutes
meantime,
before the
we have
news,
to represent people.
And then you're escaping me. I've often also wondered, for people that don't really want to be there, so you're over there, is it not a lonely experience? What do you do in London all day, every day, if you're over there?
Well, you've plenty of work to do. That's the main thing. And
do you really?
You do, yeah.
What,
you do.
On your
and
own?
Actually, being a political leader, you have a bit more work to do. And Zoom actually has been fantastic because you can do a lot of work at home when you're away.
Do you
now.
And Gregory go out for lunch?
Oh, we're always out for pints, me and Gregory. I have lots of friends over there, and it's good, and we have lots. Look, we're great friends in the Labour Party and the SNP and others, and it's important that you build those alliances.
You mentioned the Labour Party. You're still the leader of the SDLP, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you support pensioners having their winter fuel payment taken off them if they're not on pension credit?
No, absolutely not. And I vote against it at the first opportunity. And look, we're sister parties with the Labour Party. We always have been. But we're critical friends. And when we have to, we'll vote against them. We'll use influence to represent people in Derry and try and Northern Ireland more generally and try to get as much as we can. And we used that very, I think, successfully in the legacy stuff and other things. But we...
How do you know you'll vote against them? It's up to Claire to decide, is it not?
Well, I think we'll be voting against that.
Okay. And final question. And we've 2 minutes before the news. What's your advice? And look, do not say you're not one to give Claire advice. You've been the leader for 9 years.
Mm.
What's your advice to your new leader, Claire Hannah?
It's probably don't let the day-to-day stuff get you down and be relentlessly focused on the future and on the opportunities that are there. And it is to try, and this is hard sometimes, but to try and remember why we're in this and what it's about. It's not about a political party, actually. It's about the cause that you believe in. And I think Claire will be very good if she does the job at sticking to that.
And my final question is,
family's
important, isn't it? Family's important if you're able to be a politician. I've heard this from so many political leaders and politicians over the years.
Yeah, family is important, and they can be very supportive, and you put them through a lot. And I often think that it's harder for families and kids. my kids are 9 and 7 now, and they're kind of going into that age where more people will be
Are they proud of you?
Aware. I don't know, they're kids, you know, I hope so. I think they're.
Do they ever ask you about politics?
Okay, they know when you're on the posters, and their friends and people in school know, you know,
that's
who
really
I
sweet,
am and all
it?
That. And it's nice, it is lovely, and they're great, and they're happy, and that's what matters to me.
Do they want to be a politician like that?
I really hope not.
All right. Listen, good luck for what you do in the future, and thanks for spending an hour with us this morning, Colin.
No problem.
Really
Thank
appreciate
you,
it. Thank you. All the best. That's Colin Eastwood, the leader of the SDLP, giving Claire Hannah some advice at the end of that interview when Claire makes her announcement. The news at 10 is coming up next. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. The Nolan Show has been contacted by a number of officers within the PSNI who say they are angry as the LGBT organisation within the police here in Northern Ireland have sent out a memo to say that you must identify as gay for them to give support to sit police exams. The email was sent out yesterday morning to officers. It tells police officers that the LGBT network are wanting to provide some support to those of you going for promotion this year. But interestingly, it does not just offer support to members of the LGBT network within the police. It says to avail of the training, you must identify as LGBT+. So those people outside the group, they must come forward and say, I'm gay, and that will be the determinant as to whether they get this support to sit police exams. Now, if this is about equality, one of the questions here is about why that LGBT network within the police would not want to help any of their colleagues within the PSNI network. If part of being an LGBT group is to say, look, we are here to defend our rights, to make sure there's equality in the police and across Northern Ireland, why would they not be reaching out to their straight friends, to their bisexual friends, and offering that support as well? Some officers are angry. They've contacted us. Former senior police officer John Boucher, with us, John Burrows, with us this morning. a little bit of a mistake there, John Burrows. Good morning, John.
Yes, yes, it's John Burrows, not John Boucher. Yes, Stephen. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Yeah, I don't think I've heard of something like this before.
So, what does this say about that network within the police? You could argue very strongly, John. Look, well, they're there to advocate for gay rights, so they're offering training to gay people.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've of some sympathy. I think, you know, they've tried to maybe do the right thing the wrong way. That's just my instinct when your researchers rang me and read that to me. I mean, I think there's two things here. Like in any organisation, and you'll know this from the BBC, anyone listening will know from their organisation, people get very precious about promotions. Not just that they're legally compliant, but actually that there's a feeling of fairness. That really rankles. So I think if I was involved in that, I would be saying, look, LGBT network, yeah, you're there to advance the interests of your members. You either offer some coaching within your own network and say, look, this is a private thing we're doing within our network, as other groups can do. Or if you open it up to the organisation, I think you've got to open it up to everybody. You might say, as you often see in job adverts, we would strongly encourage members from the LGBT community to apply. Because they need extra support, and we know that people have extra barriers, but it's open to everybody.
It's not what this memo says. This memo says you do not have to be a member of the LGBT network to avail of this training, but you must identify as LGBT+. So you've got to talk about your sexuality.
Yeah. I think that's the flaw. I think in saying, look, it's open to people outside of our little club, our organisation, which is legally set up, or properly set up, but if you want to avail of this, you've got to tell us that you're actually LGBT. I mean, it sounds like it's actually putting a barrier up. You're having to tick a box to get access to this treatment. So they should actually be role modelling inclusivity, you know, and being welcoming to everyone and removing barriers for everybody. And of course, the other problem is, you know, I know this from being in the police service, generally there are not coaching opportunities for people going for promotion. It's really just, you know, fans for themselves.
The PSNI this morning are completely ducking and avoiding answering whether they're supporting this messaging or not. So we asked the PSNI, because, for example, it's not clear where this training, these revision classes or notes for sitting the exams, it's not clear if they will actually occur on police premises. You might have thought that they very well might, security yeah. reasons and all of that. So we asked the PSNI, look, do you support this messaging that you must identify as being gay in order to get the training? They've completely avoided answering it. And what they've done, the PSNI have issued a statement telling us nothing. They've essentially said this email was issued from the PSNI's LGBT network, offering help and support to LGBT officers within the organisation preparing for upcoming promotion processes. Now, the reason why that is very close to farcical from the PSNI is we told them that. So they've simply sent us a statement back telling us what we told them about this notice.
Yeah.
The questions to the PSNI, will they allow training on their premises where straight people are excluded because they're not gay?
I think it's a very good question. And, you know, the organisation cannot divorce itself entirely from its members and the groups within it, because it has obligations, Section 75 of the, you know, Equality Act, to act in a way that's legally compliant with equality. It's got other responsibilities. The way it works, Stephen, by the way, is in those promotion processes, there's a governance group set up to make sure they're legal, they're compliant, that all the messaging internally is managed. So I think the question would be, has this been approved by that group? Has it been given the PSNI stamp of approval?
Well, the PSNI are failing to tell us whether they've approved it or not.
Has legal advice been given? And if this was ever taken in front of an IT, it would be the PSNI who might be, you know, having to answer that. So you're quite right. It's a public organisation. Potentially this could be done on police time, police premises, police equipment. So I think the PSNI can't divorce themselves from it. They need to look at this and say, is there a better way of actually trying to address the issue, which is supporting all the different diverse people in the PSNI?
Well, let's replace let's hypothesise here. So let's replace the requirement by this LGBT group. So emphasise, this is not a group providing assistance solely to their own members. They are reaching outside their membership group and they are appealing to people who have the same sexuality as them. So let's replace in this memo, you must identify as LGBT to you must be white to have training on police premises. How would that go down?
Oh, like a lead balloon. And rightly so. And of course, you now have a Catholic Police Guild in the organisation that quite rightly supports, you know, members from that religion. If they put out something to say, look, we're going to help anyone in the organisation as long as they're Catholic, these things can be divisive. They really need to be managed carefully. And, you know, I think this is ill-advised the way it's been done. And, you know, it also opens up a Pandora's box, as you said. Is the next organisation, staff association, able to do it? You know, so in many ways, what they've done here is they've went outside of their own network and opened it up to the whole organisation and then closed it down again to certain people who identify in a certain way. And I think it's ill-advised. I think it's going to cause issues.
But how do you then reach out and ensure that minority groups, that there are more gay people in senior positions, for example?
I think...
What's wrong with these groups?
Yeah, nothing at all.
Helping some of their colleagues who they know might be struggling.
I think it's a bit like those advertisements you see on job adverts sometimes, you know, that we're equal opportunities, but we particularly encourage females and Catholics to apply. I've seen one recently in the Northern Ireland Civil Service. We particularly encourage men and Protestants to apply because they're underrepresented. So I think it's about how you do it. I think the language could be better, and I think they'd be better saying, look, we're conscious that some people in the organisation feel there's a barrier to promotion. So what we're going to do is have a promotion coaching class. We're going to open it up to everybody, but we really encourage people who are LGBT to apply. We're going to make sure it's a very safe environment for you and you're supported, but it's open to everybody. And I think that would be the way to do that. I think you're going down a very dangerous path here.
The questions I have. So this memo was distributed within the PSNI. And while the police service are trying to avoid expressing an opinion in this, I just wonder how they can how they can withstand that for much longer. Because the question here also is, for this LGBT network within the police, what do they think their messaging is to their straight colleagues?
Yeah, that's the thing.
Why does sexuality matter? Would they not want to be sitting in a room with their friends and colleagues within the police and they're all getting as much training as they can in order to go for this job within the police? And how many gay people within the PSNI would actually think that this is wrong, that they don't want their sexuality to be any factor whatsoever when they're sitting training for a job?
Yeah, what they'll want to make sure is a level playing field, that everything's fair and legally compliant. I understand the sentiment that you're posing. I do think it's very tricky. And look, this has went out to 6,300 officers if it's been sent out widely across the organisation. So I think the PSNI have to take a position on it. And there's another quirk to this, Stephen, in that you don't have to be gay. You can be straight and be in the LGBT network. So they do welcome people who are straight in the network because they're champions, etc. So you're
no, but that's not what this is.
Yeah,
it's not about being in the network. You must identify as LGBT.
Exactly. And my point is,
and how do you do that? How do you identify? Do you put your hand up and say, here's my sex life? How do you identify as LGBT?
You almost have to come out of and identify yourself. The point I was making is there's a quirk here that some straight people will be able to take part in this if you're in the network. Other straight people who aren't in the network won't be able to take part in it. You know, so it's really complex when you start running it through. I think it's ill-advised. They'd be far better, you know. And look, at the end of the day, the PSNI, this has went out to Z All Police, from what I've heard, that everybody's seen it. Certainly from what your research is indicating, that you know, this has went out to everybody. You know, the police can't divorce themselves from it. The PSNI need to sit down and say, is this legally compliant? Is this fair? Do we need to think of this again? Is there ways we can encourage people from underrepresented groups, make sure they get the support in this level playing field without making this divisive? And I think this needs a rethink because it opens up Pandora's box and it just rankles with people. I'm going to guess this is rankling with people.
There are those who are angry. There are others who are saying, look, what's the story here? It's an LGBT group trying to bring X resource to people who identify as LGBT. But let's see. John, thank you very much. Morning to you. 16 minutes past 10, 0:30, 30:80, 55:55. What about history made for Irish League football last night? Larne Football Club beating Lincoln Reds of Gibraltar at Inver Park to qualify for the league phase of the Conference League.
It's a poor touch and is pounced upon by Thompson. Ryan does really well. 2-on-2. Here comes McGee. Ryan's in the middle. Andy Ryan onto the right foot.
Oh,
that's a goal that could be worth £2.5 million. A hat trick for Ryan. A clinical counter attack for Larne, who are now on the brink of history. They've done it. Larne's European adventure goes on. They make history.
Well, Larne chairman Kenny Bruce is with us this morning. Morning, Kenny.
Good morning, Stephen.
What's it feel like?
It feels amazing. It's incredible for the whole community. The club and the Northern Irish football contingent really have been amazing in terms of all the support. It's been quite a journey over the last 8 years, and to get to the elite stages of a European competition and create history for the very first time is something quite special.
Well, Kenny, you took over in 2017, when Larne were bottom of the second tier of the Irish League. They were bottom. What vision had you back then? And how much did money, and you've put a lot of money into the club, haven't you? How much did money matter?
Money played a part, of course, Stephen. You would expect that. But I was extremely inspired by Tiernan Lynch and his brother, Seamus, who really created everything on the field in terms of what we wanted to try and achieve. We wanted to go full time. We wanted to develop an academy. We wanted to improve our facilities and have a really professional environment that created and nurtured a great culture. And I was truly inspired by their vision and bought into it. And what originally sort of laid out for me was going to be a sort of small investment became a significant investment because I was inspired by the impact that football could have on a community. And the Larn people got behind us incredibly, and we have achieved this remarkable feat together. It's been something that's been truly remarkable.
Yeah, you're a businessman, so money's important. So you envisaged spending how much, and then how much did you spend?
Well, I think today's not really about money. Today's about incredible achievement.
Yeah, no, it is. But absolutely,
glass ceiling.
But you absolutely it is, and we're going to talk a lot about this. But I guess it's a relevant question because it shows how much you need money. You need a backer. You've put 5 million into the club. Is that right?
We certainly have invested many millions of pounds, but we've done it, I think, Stephen, quite strategically. We've invested it significantly in our facilities. If you look at Inver Park last night, and you see nearly 3,000 people in that stadium, and they're all home fans, and all of the stands look amazing, the pitch looks amazing, new floodlights, great clubhouses, great lounges for people to enjoy. So we tried not only to invest in the first team and in players' wages and infrastructure, but we invested very, very heavily in our facilities, which I think has helped to create a sustainable model that now we've got going on at Larn Football Club.
Players might be wanting more wages after these performances, Kenny.
The bonuses are very, very healthy for what they achieved last night. So I think the guys will be proud and pleased this morning.
I didn't even know they were bonus. Is that the way it works? Is that the I genuinely didn't know. Is that the way it works?
Well, look, every player and every coach in their contracts will be getting a bonus for achieving this remarkable thing last night in terms of getting to group stages. And
thousands?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly, there's no question that money will play a part in this achievement today. That they will be rewarded for the remarkable efforts to overcome the adversity that our players did last night. We went down 1-0. We then lost our captain at half time. We then had a player sent off, and for us to win that game in 90 minutes, these players pulled something out of the bag, which was just truly, truly remarkable, and they deserve everything that they will receive in terms of rewards for that incredible effort.
And have you seen the camaraderie? Have you seen the sense of team making a fundamental difference?
No question. We've always, as leaders, had in our minds that we can create the right environment. That's our strategy. That's our responsibility. But the culture gets fostered in that the right environment, and there's no question that our team, our players, have gotten a remarkable camaraderie, a remarkable culture, and that's actually spread right through the community. We've seen now people in Larn coming together from all sections of the world and community and doing remarkable things in terms of enjoying the experience that the boys are providing for them.
So what do you put that down to? Because, look, Glentoran, Linfield, Cliftonville, they'll be Crusaders, they'll be looking at Larn with envy now. Why couldn't they do that? What's the difference with your lot?
Well, I think, look, the great thing about it is somebody was always going to achieve this remarkable feat. Somebody was always going to break through this glass ceiling. I think what Larn have achieved last night gives everybody else great hope that this can be achieved on a regular basis. This is significant for Irish League football, and the Irish League football family got really behind Larn, allowing us to postpone fixtures leading up to this remarkable playoff opportunity. And that helped us to get through, and every club in Northern Ireland in the Premier League will benefit from our achievements, and I think we'll set a new precedent for everybody to be able to achieve this in the future. So there's no question that Linfield, Glentoran, Crusaders, Cliftonville and others will achieve this feat in the future.
Yeah, but might they be now worried? Because you will get money. Money will flow to Larn from this. It's a couple of million, isn't it? So will that help cement your ambition to be at the top? The Glentorans, the Cliftonvilles can't compete because you've got the money.
We will try and do everything properly, which again will be investing in facilities, investing in our academy, investing in our community engagement programmes. So it isn't just going to be about first team football. Now, of course, we're going to try and strengthen our team. We're going to try and compete as every club does during the summer. But we're going to spend this money very wisely. We believe we have a sustainable model. This will help significantly towards that sustainability, and I think other clubs are following suit, so they will achieve those windfalls as well in the future.
And you've said there, Kenny, strengthen the team. Does that mean buy new players?
Well, of course the window closes today, so we won't be spending transfer fees on players over the next 24 hours. But what we will say is, based upon the financial fair play regulations that are being introduced by NIFL, we have to spend this money very wisely. We have to make sure that this is going to be help LAN to be sustainable for the long term.
So what does that mean? Where will the money go?
Well, the money will go into facilities, into academy, into infrastructure, into operations. It will be spent very wisely and also saved for future generations. So this has been a remarkable achievement, and we will make sure that LAN benefits for future generations off the back of this remarkable success.
I guess if you're, you know, you're clearly a very successful businessman, you made your money with online estate agents, Purple Bricks, didn't you? And you sold your stake in it. Maybe it's time for you to sell the club, make your money.
Well, look, this has meant more to me than business. This has been something that's been the heart that's driven this. I love my hometown, LAN. I'm proud of what everyone has achieved here. I'm proud of how the community's come together and got behind the vision that we've laid out. We've had remarkable support from supporters, remarkable support from volunteers, incredible support from our business owners here in the community. So from our perspective, this isn't a business transaction. This isn't about money. This is about how you can try and galvanise a community and create a greater success for the future. And we've managed to do that, which is brilliant for everybody.
If you qualified, imagine LAN against Chelsea.
It'll be something remarkable. If we can bring Chelsea to our national stadium, and every person that's interested in football.
What am I saying? If you qualified, you did qualify. So imagine that draw comes out today, Chelsea.
It'll be remarkable. It'll be something that to behold. It really will be brilliant. And the great thing about it is getting a showcase tie like that will be a just rewards for the players, coaches and their families and all of our staff and volunteers who can go there and really showcase themselves and enjoy that experience. It will be something to behold for sure.
And when you look, we're both older people. When you must see that excitement, that sense of achievement and also continued ambition within those players, young players, that must be exciting too.
Yeah, we have a remarkable academy. We've got a guy called Andrew Mitchell, who's our youth technical director, who's building a remarkable academy of young talent who we believe will be the future of LAN Football Club. And that's not to take away what all of the guys have achieved now, but you've got to invest in the youth. You've got to invest in the future. And we're doing that, successfully running our academy out of the LAN Academy of Sport in LAN. And it's a brilliant place. It's a great place to learn. Lots of really great things happening there. And you only had to look around Inver Park last night to see the number of families, the number of young kids that were there, and the celebrations
That's
of
lovely.
Those young children when that winning goal went in. It was just something that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Oh, it's so lovely, isn't it? It's just beautiful. Brilliant. Andy, you're a fan. Morning, Andy. A season ticket holder.
Morning, Stephen. Morning.
How do you feel, Andy?
Oh, incredible. It was absolutely incredible last night. The game was there. As Kenny says, it had everything, you know, coming in 2-1 down from last week and going a goal down, losing the captain with a hamstring injury, getting a red card, and then Andy Ryan gets a hat-trick. It was one of the most incredible games I think we've ever been at.
And look, if we talk, Andy, about LAN has been the butt of many, many jokes over the years. Like, what is there in LAN? This is one of the biggest success stories to come out of LAN, for goodness sake. This is beyond football.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it galvanises, as Kenny said, it's galvanised the community, the fans. The stadium was packed last night. There's a real buzz around the town. Just everyone's talking about it. Schools are excited. All the kids in school are excited going back. And it's the talk of the town. So it's superb.
I was, as a little boy, I used to squeeze in the turnstile with my father. And as my belly got bigger, I had to get a season ticket of my own. I was a Glentoran season ticket holder back in the day. Maybe it's time to jump ship, Andy.
Maybe. You might have to come down to Inver Park. We'll have you down, no problem, Steve.
What are the burgers like?
Oh, yes, very good. definitely worth the burger down here as well.
So what about the future here, Andy, and the prospect of playing against a big club?
Well, you know, the massive teams in the draw, as Kenny was saying, Fiorentina, Copenhagen, Betis, Chelsea, Panathinaikos, the massive European teams. So even just getting an away game, going there will be incredible. But having them having to play the home games at the National Stadium.
Windsor Park.
Windsor Park. So really, really good. Really good.
What are the numbers like these days?
In terms of the ground?
Yeah. Kenny, can you maybe help me with that? Like, would you have no problem filling Windsor Park?
Well, look, at Inver Park, we have gone through remarkable growth over the last 8 years. We're now seeing full houses on a regular basis, which is fantastic, and great away facilities and support. We would anticipate that lots of people that are interested in football will be galvanised by this remarkable achievement. And I think Windsor Park, if you've got a glamour tie like Chelsea, I think could be very easily be full with lots of football fans coming to support a local Northern Irish team against a remarkable elite side like Chelsea. I think you'd fill Windsor Park for that type of tie for sure.
When the draw's this afternoon, when's the game?
We'll know the fixtures, probably October it starts. So we have six fixtures, three at home, three away. And Stephen, this is more than football. This is more than what Larne have achieved. It's more than what the community of Larne have achieved. This is historical moment for Northern Irish football, and I think, as I say, it's something that will go down in history as being something that we should all be very proud of as a football family, because we've come together and we've been able to create this opportunity, and we took full advantage of it last night. And I think having remarkable teams like Chelsea or Florentina or Copenhagen at our national stadium playing one of our Irish league clubs will set a precedent for other clubs in the future, which is just really exciting.
Well, listen, Stuff Glen Tourne, if you can find me a double X Larne shirt, I'll buy one. I want to share this excitement. As long as the shirt's big enough.
You can be guaranteed we're going to have one for you.
All right. Kenny, thanks for being on. Thank you, Andy. Thanks, everyone. See you in 5 Live tonight at 10 o'clock. Have a good weekend. See you tonight.
Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.